Weeks ago, my children were kind enough to take me to Ireland and England, and the opportunity to be reunited with brethren that I had worked with in that part of the world many years ago, and it was a delight. But this has been similar, because I'm in a part of the world that I love, and I'm associated with people that have meant so much to me through the years, and I'm just thankful for the opportunity. I anticipated that there might be some little difference in approach by the way speakers to this series, but I've been surprised at the unity of our feelings and beliefs, even in some matters of judgment. It appears we've been reading the same book, and in many instances having the same experiences, and I'm thankful for that. I may say some things this morning that some would like to have the opportunity for rebuttal. I suppose that'll come in the question and answer period, but I do hope that I can at least challenge you in your thinking on these various matters that I'm going to discuss. The Apostle Paul went into the temple and offered sacrifices to prove that he was not against keeping the customs of the Jews. And I'm going to start with the Old Testament to prove that I'm not. Turn to the book of Esther. It's very difficult for us in our modern time to understand how a king could control the lives of people thousands of miles away, even without modern communications. But that's exactly what was accomplished by those ancient empires. And people today in the religious world don't understand how a king who lived 2,000 years ago and is far away in heaven can possibly control a kingdom in which he is truly the ruler, the monarch, the one authority. But I think there's a comparison there, and I'm going to make the comparison to begin with this morning. The king lived in Susa, but his people were far, far away. And when there was some kind of a decision to be made, or some law that was to be followed, there was a certain manner by which he communicated with individuals in distant places. You remember the story of Esther and how Haman had told the king on the idea of putting to death all of the Jews in his domain. And beginning with verse 12, we see how that was to be accomplished. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to that what Haman commanded, to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all the people, to every province according to its script, and every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus, it was written and sealed with the king's signet. And the letters were sent by couriers. Those would be the messengers. And to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate. You must add the lawyers. All the Jews, both young and old, little children and women. In one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. This was accomplished because of the scribes, the messengers, and the local officials. I believe there's a comparison to be made with the New Testament kingdom of our Lord. I'd like for us to look for just a moment at this passage that has been so often used, and one that I think we should come back to again and again and again. When he ascended on high, that's Ephesians 4, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives, and he gave gifts to men. I believe that Daniel 7:13-14 describes his ascending on high and coming before the Ancient of Days. And he gave gifts to men. And what were those gifts? He gave the apostles and prophets. And were they not the scribes that would take down his message and write it in a very dependable manner? In fact, he was so determined they would write what should be written that he endowed with them the Holy Spirit so that he could give the message from above. But in addition, there were evangelists. And are they not the messengers who go forth telling the message that was written by the apostles and prophets? And then in addition, there were the shepherds and teachers. And these were the local servants in the local communities who received the message from evangelists that had been originally given by the apostles and prophets. Now, this doesn't prove the point I'm going to make, but it fits, at least. The question I want to ask is, were the messengers accountable to the king or to the local officials who received the message? Obviously, they were accountable to the king. And I'm convinced that an evangelist today is accountable primarily to the questioning. Is he accounted primarily to the chief church supporting him or to the Lord? And there are several questions that I think need to be viewed in light of what this implies. Do churches hire a preacher? Should a church and an evangelist have a contract? Should salaries be negotiated? I've actually known of older preachers who encouraged younger preachers when they were talking to a church about a possible move to ask for more than you really need, and the church will offer you less, and then you can negotiate to get to a medium position. Is that proper? Can the church demand office hours and tell the preacher that he has to be in the office from 9 to 5 because the members might want to get in touch with him? Can the church limit his preaching away? Can the church determine his vacation time, when it will be, how long it will be, and how he can use it? Can a church dictate what he will preach? Can a church regulate the length of his sermons? These would have been very strange questions in the beginning of what we sometimes call the Restoration Movement. In that time, men just preached the gospel. And if they had an opportunity to do so in a schoolhouse, they did. If it was in a home, they used it. If it was in a brush arbor, they used it. And the idea of being supported even was very, very strange to them. Some were rich, actually, on a private basis. Campbell was a rather rich man. And there were some doctors that were also preaching the gospel. And they had independent sources of income. But many were just plain old dirt farmers who had to farm all day long. And then they would preach in the evening wherever they could find people to listen to them. And the idea that I want to be an evangelist, but I can't find a preaching job, just doesn't make sense. That would never have been dreamed of in the early days in our country, or even in other countries. And incidentally, the idea of restoration was not born in America. I read the other day that the church was finally restored under the umbrella of the U.S. Constitution, of all things. That makes no sense at all.
Amen.
But it was common in my early days to hear a lot of preaching against the one-man pastor system and the idea of clergy and laity. Gus Dunn was a very prominent and popular preacher, and he was constantly speaking against those things. He did so in a little bit of a humorous way, and people didn't take it too seriously, I don't think. I recall when I was teaching in Alabama Christian, or maybe in Montgomery Bible School, it had been changed while I was there, we had a lectureship, and there was a forum in the afternoon. And Brother Dunn was in charge of the forum each day. And he spent most of his time complaining about the clergy system. Brother Ed Holt was in the group, and he knew some things about Brother Dunn. And he raised his hand one time, said, "Brother Dunn, can all of us ride on a clergy pass on the railway?" He knew that Brother Dunn had the clergy pass, taking advantage of a discount. Brother Dunn said, "Brother Holt, you joke too much." Some men like Carl Kitchenside were much more aggressive with their opposition to supporting preachers, or at least put it sometimes, locating preachers. And they painted themselves into a corner because of their extremes. Those men opposed to like located preachers. But just like Philip was located in Samaria, or rather in Caesarea, for 15 or 20 years. We don't know how to do it at all, for sure. But it was for a long period of time. They opposed evangelists where there were elders. But Paul sent Timothy to Ephesus where there were elders. And they talked about stipulated salaries. But Paul said he received wages. And the word wages is exactly the same word that's used with reference to support of soldiers who help amongst the step in, which they understand is to be received. As a result of some of these extremes, they lost their influence. And of course, men like Leo Garrett and Carl Kitchenside, in their efforts to get out of the corner they painted themselves into, went past Jerusalem and wound up in Jericho, as someone has said. They made their bounds too wide and became quite liberal. But the fact is that the churches, I think, have suffered from the lack of warnings about what had developed. In the absence of those warnings, churches began following up their models. And what models were available? Well, of course, the business model of the employer and the employee. And more elders became men who were familiar with business practices. And they operated the church in many ways as they operated their businesses. There were the denominational arrangements, clergy and laity being divided. And then there's the city form of government, city manager. The city council oversees the general administration, makes policies, sets budgets, but they appoint a professional city manager to carry out the day-to-day administrative operations. And if things go well, he's rewarded. But if things don't go well, he's fired and they seek another city manager. And I'm afraid that all too often that's become the form or the model for the operation of churches. They employ a preacher to run the church. They may employ him because he has some kind of magic plan that's used in some other place, and they want him to use that there. And in many ways, that simply means turning over the direction of the church to the preacher. I believe that a preacher is accountable directly to the Lord. And as I look for a passage of Scripture, it would be 2 Timothy 2:4. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier. It's the Lord who enlists us as soldiers, and I believe we're accountable to him. We are to please him and not to please men, even men who are elders of the church. But we'll talk about that more. I believe that not the elders are accountable directly to the Lord. He's accountable to him for what he preaches, for where he preaches, and for how he preaches. He is to preach whether he's supported or not. Churches should support him if they approve of his work. After all, Philippi had financial fellowship with Paul while he was with them. He said from the first day until now, he and Paul and his companions lived in the home of Lydia, and she provided for him. And in that, they were having fellowship the very first day that the church began. In addition, when he went to Thessalonica, they sent once and again to his necessities. And then when he left Macedonia and Achaia, they sent to his needs. And I believe in Acts 18:55 is a reception of the support that they sent so that he could give himself totally or fully, as the New American Standard suggests, to the matter of evangelizing. And it's in that connection that he says in 2 Corinthians 11, 8 and 9, that I robbed other churches, taking wages of them, that I might not be accountable to you. Paul made, well, that last line is not correct, for not the correct quotation, but the idea was that they would not have to support him. Paul made the decisions about where he would preach and when he would preach. Now, continuing, churches do not have to have resident evangelists. That's something that many times we have come to believe, but it's just not true. A gospel preacher came to talk to us once in Atlanta when we didn't have an elder, and he just made the statement that a church, if it's without a preacher for 1 week, and nothing is being done to get another preacher, everybody gets all nervous. But it can go for 20 years without elders, and nobody seems to be concerned. The Bible does teach that every church needs elders, and the church is not complete until it has elders. On the other hand, there are evidence that there were many churches that did not have what we would call a resident evangelist, fully supported by the church. And one of the reasons that there's such a preacher shortage is that now every church thinks they have to have a supported evangelist among them. I wouldn't have been preaching for several years. I don't know about Brother Colley, but if it had not been the fact that there were many little rural churches around that didn't have a resident evangelist. And it was about the time of the Second World War just being over, and there was a terrible manpower shortage, and so they had to put up with boys, and so they put up with me. You figure yourself about that, Colley. But I'm sure what I offered was inferior teaching, but at least they needed someone to preach, and they let me do it, and I'm thankful for the opportunity I had. But now, there are not opportunities much for young men to develop as far as preaching in congregations as the opportunity was mine. Sometimes churches need help, though, that an evangelist can give. They can increase their usefulness and be further developed by the good teaching of an evangelist. The church in Ephesus needed an evangelist, even though they had elders. I don't know whether they knew it or not, but Paul knew it. And Paul sent Timothy there to advance them. If a church realizes its need for a resident evangelist, They can identify an evangelist they trust. They may invite him to come and work with them. But he must try to determine whether that's what the Lord wants him to do, and not simply whether it's a promotion to a bigger church, or an opportunity for more money, or more prestige, something that will help his career. Those good things should not be considered at all. In my judgment, and I believe this is taught by the scriptures, he needs to decide whether that's a work the Lord would have him to do. I like to think of the Lord almost as the manager of a big company. And he says, I need somebody over there, that's fine. He doesn't actually tell us. But I think we try to determine, would he put me there? Is that where I can serve best? And no other consideration, really, I think, should be given. Well, there may be family consideration and other things. But basically, if I ask the Lord, should I go there or should I not go there? That's really the question that needs to be asked. And I might just say that this is one of the most difficult questions that preachers preach to face. Brother Paul talked about staying awake at night, worrying about problems because you're an elder. And I serve for an elder, as an elder, and I know what that means. I could have the same experience. But sometimes as a preacher, I've had the same problem. An opportunity to move somewhere and wondered if that's what I should do. Or maybe no call except a sense of a need that I knew that existed in a certain place. And the question was, am I needed more there than I'm needed here? What effect is it going to do to this local work of belief? Can they replace me easily, quickly? Is my work pretty well done here? Or am I more needed? Should I go to another place? That's something you just have to work out with your conscience. Work out with the Lord. I don't think you need to be flitting from place to place. I've had people call me and say, we've got a great work that needs to be done over here. Would you come and help us? And they describe a good work. But I sometimes respond with, I really can't see a reason for leaving one good work to go to another good work. I need to spend some more time working here where I am. And I'm just going to say one thing, working on the business model. There was a businessman that called me once, and he was an elder of a church. And it's something that I haven't experienced often. I've had preachers tell me they just won't leave me alone from this particular congregation. I haven't had that experience, but I did have one brother that called me, and he wanted me to think about moving to the church where he was an elder. And he said, we have a fine preacher's home. And I knew that. I'd been in that home, and it was a nicer home than the home I lived in. And he mentioned several other things, and we'll give you a good salary. You just need to come. And I kept saying, no, I don't think I can make a change. Finally, he said, what would it take to get you to move? He didn't know it. But frankly, I felt insulted. I just plain felt insulted. I told him what I thought the Lord would want me to do. And now he's trying to lure me with more money or something that he could offer me in a business way that would make me change my mind. I think any of us should be turned off of that kind of thing. If it's a matter of the Lord's need and some work that needs to be done that I'm peculiarly qualified to do, I need to be careful and pay attention. But if it's just a matter of a bigger church or greater prestige or a career move that's good for my reputation, that's nothing to consider, because you and I, if we're evangelists, are under the Lord's responsibility. If he comes to this church that invites him and convinces him that there's a need, they should support him if they can. I'm aware that Galatians 6:5 is primarily for individuals, but him that is taught in the word, communicate with him that teaches and all those things. But there's no reason in the world that couldn't be applied to a group. If a group of Christians are being taught by a certain brother, they certainly have a personal responsibility, according to their ability, to support him in what he's doing. If they're not able, others may support him. 2 Corinthians 11 is proof of that. I rob other churches, take the wages of them. If he ceases to be needed, I believe they can cease his support. If a church can begin to support man, I believe they can discontinue his support. Now, there ought to be a consideration of his family, his needs. The golden rule most certainly applies. And I've known the churches that give man almost no notice and tell him, you've got to move on. I don't think that's treating him fairly. And I think he has a right to be hurt by that. But as a rule, when he's getting into something else, I think he's better off just to go ahead and leave quietly and not to cause a big stir. And you have one brother that was dismissed, as we might say, on a rather short term, but he took it well. He went on and preached the gospel. And some years later, he was invited back to that same place. And he went and served well. His conduct in that first case had actually recommended him for another period of work with that church. If elders disagree with him, they may forbid his preaching in the church over which they have overseer. I firmly believe that. I remember preaching something during the integration crisis in the house, and the elders called me in and said, did we understand you to say this? I said, yes, that's exactly what I said. And that's what I've got to say. And if you'll let me, I'll continue saying it here. But if you won't let me say it here, I'll have to say it somewhere else. I'll have to go where it will be tolerated and where we can speak. I don't think we have the right to overrule elders. Now, it is a matter of major doctrinal nature that involves the salvation of souls. I may want to go to another part of town and preach it. But we should do that with great, great caution. It's a serious matter, a very serious matter, to divide the church. And I think that we have sometimes allowed ourselves to become callous to that. It's a serious matter. And it only should be done when we're convinced that that's the Lord wants, what the Lord wants to be done. We must not compromise or to please elders or anyone else. But a man do owe something to a church when they answer that call. A church called them to come and do the work of the man among them. And I'm just going to list some things. Very obvious is the fact that a church calls me because they recognize a need that needs to be filled. They describe that to me. And I say, well, I'll come and do that work. Then I have a responsibility to do that work. That's the reason I've gone. And I have a responsibility to be very, very careful to do it. And I need to be careful to avoid anything that would interfere with this work that I have agreed to do. Anything that might seem reasonable to me, but if it's going to interfere with my doing what I committed to do, believing it was the Lord's will for me to do it, then I have made a mistake. I must become all things to all men. And I could talk about that quite a long time. I think you understand that churches in different parts of the country, even, and certain churches in different parts of the world, have different cultural standards. And I believe that a man going to any such church should do his very best to fit into the culture where he's preaching. And I think that's exactly what Paul is saying in the 9th chapter of the book of 1 Corinthians. I believe an elder has a responsibility to support the elders, for the leadership in the church, and work together with them and not in opposition to them. All too often there develops kind of a tension or a competition between elders and the preacher for influence in the congregation. A preacher should never be in a part of that. I think that's totally out of order. He needs to be willing to accept advice for successful service. And I believe that the elders will be a special source of help in that. There's a need over here with a certain number of our members that you're preaching every Sunday, and you need to address that thing from the scriptures. I think that the preacher that represents being receiving advice from help had a wrong spirit or a wrong attitude. John the Baptist told the soldier to be content with their wages. And the preacher that's just constantly asking for more, 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 reminds you of the Old Testament prophet, doesn't it? More, more, more. I think that the church should give a man what he needs, but a preacher ought to be willing to live pretty well on the average of what the congregation does. Preachers are in a, how much more time I get before in here?
14.
Preachers kind of have a strange association. Doctors generally associate with doctors, and teachers with teachers. And blue-collar workers with blue-collar workers. And so they see the standard of the people with whom they are peers. But a preacher is different than that. One day, or one week, and I've actually experienced this kind of thing, I've spent a week in a very poor home, sleeping on a youth bed, because that was all they could supply. And I was grateful for it, appreciated it. Next week in the millionaire's home, going out on the lake in his yacht or his speedboat and enjoying the benefits of that a millionaire enjoys. And it's easy for a preacher to want to live like some of the brethren, not that poor family out there. They don't stir my imagination for that much. But the wonder is, why can't I have a beach house? And why can't I have a speedboat? And why? And so you get the point. And so we actually can become restless because we don't have what some of the brethren have. That's not the standard that's been governed us. It's a matter of what we can use wisely in the service of the Lord. One brother said to me one time, "You care freely," and I considered it a compliment. That's the kind of thing I wanted to do. To request a periodic review of his work is not out of order. I rather express, as a rule, before I was an elder myself, would ask the elders, "Are you satisfied with my work? Should I be looking for some kind of change?" And if they're not satisfied with the work I'm doing, I don't want to stay there. I want to try to find a work that I can do where it would be fitted to my talents and vice versa. And if we're asked to do so, I mentioned this a moment ago, to lead peacefully and not destroy the unity and the love that exists in the church. But most of you are, and I hesitate to use this word, but I don't say missionaries. That suggests the idea of someone who's preaching one place and getting support from another. So let that be my definition of missionary, and maybe move on. This makes self-discipline all the more important. When you're working among the brethren who support you, You have to maintain a certain standard because there's an eye watching you, and you're aware of that fact. And if you're lazy and not doing anything, there's going to be some unrest in the congregation. But when you're preaching 700 miles away from the brethren that are supporting you, they don't know what you're doing. They don't know what you're not doing. And it's just pretty evident that some brethren in places like that, like some of the places where you preach, would not be supported by a church that supports its local preacher. You can get support to preach 700 miles away from a church that would not let you preach for them. And that is something you need to think about. And realize that you have a same responsibility to the Lord when you're preaching to people that don't support you as you have when you're being supported by the brethren to whom you preach. What are some things you owe the brethren in the 700 mile road that may be supporting you? But in the first place, I think you have a responsibility to communicate with them. Paul spoke about his fellowship in the gospel. And fellowship is two ways. And it's more than just writing a check and getting the check out of the mailbox and cashing it, using it. It's a sense of being fellow workers. The book of Philippians is an excellent model for communication between a preacher who may be supported and the church is supporting him. He gives them thanks for the fellowship they've had with him from the first day to the last. And he even mentions specifically, of course, in the latter part, their help to him while he was a prisoner. He reports to them what he's doing, even in his chains. And he reports to them the success, what he's doing, so that the whole guard has come to know about Christ. He expresses confidence in them. I may have written the poem on that here. I don't know. I don't remember my own chart. But he expresses confidence in them. And this is so important. It bothers me sometimes for preachers, say in the north, and that's where I've had some experience, to make fun of the churches down south and to ridicule what sometimes is really caricature. I know the churches in the South, and so much of what's said about them is not accurate. It's not the way it is. Now, there may be some isolated church that's truly what's being described, but as a rule, that's not true. And it seems to me, well, what is it? To be critical and to actually almost make fun of brethren who are putting food on your table. Those brethren are due respect. They're to be appreciated. And though they have their problems, many times they're kind of problems if you've grown up in the north, you don't understand those problems. And I was really glad that our brother Paul spoke about what it means to be elders, so that even local preachers, if please, as well as missionaries, will understand what elders are dealing with. And those elders need the communication. The church needs the communication that you provide by even offering to visit. Don't push yourself on that. But if you offer and they accept, take advantage of it. We should express gratitude and confidence. And be absolutely honest about our finances. I remember one brother, good brother, I loved him, but he was in a financial crisis, and he reported to the church, and they gave him a big raise. And right after that, the country where he was devalued their money, and he was just abounding in wealth. Well, that's too strong a statement. He was much more prosperous than he'd been before. But he didn't report that to the brethren. He just went on enjoying the abundance that was produced by the change in the economy. We need to be absolutely honest about our finances. And I found this. On one or two occasions, rather than send me a sum of money to be used for a purpose, and after I had used it, I had maybe not too much, $100, $150 left over. And when I sent it back, that pretty well assured when I needed something in the future that I would get it. You do, honest is not only right, but honest is the best policy in dealing with churches that are supporting them. And if, I want to emphasize this. If you have a major change of convictions so that you believe something the local church supporting you does not know you believe and believes and teaches elsewise, you need to level with them. It's not right. It is dishonest to take money from churches when they think you're preaching one thing, but in reality you're preaching something different. It's totally dishonest. And though we're responsible first and foremost to the Lord, I don't want to face the Lord with that kind of responsibility on my shoulders. What you owe the brethren with whom you work. And I'm talking now about your work with the church when you're being supported from a distance. You owe them something. First, to encourage self-support. There's such a thing as a wealth mentality that characterized many churches just as sure as there's a mentality that characterized individuals. And churches can become sponges and live off other brethren for years when it really doesn't make sense. I remember one brother that was working with a church, I'll tell you where, that wrote to the elders, or I was an elder at the time, and said, I need a raise. And I told the other elders, that church has been receiving support for 25 years that I can tell. And if they can't give him the raise he needs, then he just needs to move on. And so we gave him 6 months' notice. We said, after 6 months, we're going to discontinue our support. And he was preaching it, I recall correctly, back to 6 months, but I didn't give him any sense of responsibility, but that law. He needed to be teaching those brethren. If they can't teach, give him any more than $50 a month, they need to begin carrying their own load and not continue to be dependent upon other churches. He has an obligation to maintain a good relationship with the church he's preaching. That includes you brethren who are being supported from a distance. You need to maintain a good relationship with the church where you are. That it may not affect your income, but it affects your work. And you're working for the Lord. And the success of your work is going to be judged by the Lord. And you can get along with the brethren that you're preaching to, even though your check may continue to come and they don't know what to do about it. You still are diligent to be united with them and to work with them the best you can. And you have a responsibility to train and develop teachers. I'm impressed with the comparison between Acts the 20th chapter, between the work Paul said he had done and what he was telling those elders they needed. In fact, he said, I've given you an example. And if Paul's work before they had elders was an example of the kind of thing that elders needed to do, be willing to transfer some of that responsibility in particular, that leadership, to the elders, but continue to do the work of strengthening the weak and sacrificing for them that you have been sent to do to that particular place. Well, I'm out of breath and out of soul. So we'll stop right there, and I think I'm out of time too.
You've got 3 minutes.
Take
a deep breath if you want.
All right. Well, that's what I've been and be saved.
Amen.
And I'm glad we have a little bit of a question and answer period. I may be embarrassed by it, but there may be some things that need to be clarified, and I'll be glad to do the best I can.
Okay. All right, thank you, Brother Hall. We'll take about a 7-minute break, and then we'll do the question and answer period.